Hello and welcome to Ordinary, a podcast that aims to help Christians live for Christ in everyday life. My name is Josh Bannister, and each week I'm joined by Graham Nichols and Mark Bentham, both pastors of Christ Church, Haywards Heath. This week we're continuing our conversation with evangelist Glenn Scrivener. This is a really practical episode in which Glenn talks us through four questions you could ask any non-believing friend to get them thinking and talking about the big stuff of life. So enjoy the podcast, I'm sure you'll find it helpful, and I'll catch you again on the other side.
Hello, my name is Graham Nichols.
And I'm Mark Bentham, and this is Ordinary.
We're glad to welcome back our special guest, Glenn Scrivener. Lives in the Sunshine Coast, down at Eastbourne, in Sussex in the UK. And Glenn, last time you were talking about evangelism and you introduced us to four questions you like to take people through. And so maybe you could just ask those questions again and we'll start to kind of develop. Four questions that you find really helpful in people sharing Jesus with their friends and family.
Can you remember them, Graham?
I think I can remember them. One's to do with what gets you up, what gets you down. And I very can't good. Remember the other two just off the top of my head.
Thinking.
What gets you thinking?
Okay. What gets you through?
What gets you through? That is because you wrote them down.
Mark. Then no one needs to know that.
10 points in control of round two to Mark Bentham.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
So you were beginning to talk a little bit about question one. So question one is what gets you up? And you kind of said what gets you up in the morning. Is what you really mean is what motivates you? What drives you? Is that the sort of question?
Exactly, yeah. What's the biggest passion in your life? What do you love? Get people talking about that, and they'll start talking about perhaps their careers, perhaps their sports teams. What they normally talk about most would be family, I think. I don't know. Yes. What would you guys say if you were asked what gets you up in the morning?
Well, it depends whether we're trying to be sort of Christian and give a good answer, like, you know, telling people about Jesus, serving the church, those kind of things. Or if we're feeling a bit not so spiritual, we might say breakfast or some fun thing that we're going out to.
Caffeine.
Yeah, possibly.
I think
my experience, sorry, Mark, is that, talking to other people at least, is that family is a major thing. That's probably the more common thing. So there are kind of specialist interests. It might be in sport or some other hobby. But family is quite a strong thing, which is kind of weird considering the fracturing of family life in our country, but it is a thing that people would often say right across the board, all kind of ages.
I reckon work's still up there as well for some. Yeah. Especially if you love your work, I think some people just, you know, you're up for it and get up and out.
Yeah.
Or if they're thinking their day on there, they're thinking, actually, what gets me up? I've just got to get to work. But it may be to get to work in order to finance family.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I was being honest, what gets me up often, if I wasn't trying to give like the right answer, apart from breakfast and all those things, is probably work in some way. So I'll often get up early because I've got lots to do. Now, it happens my work's to do with church stuff, but often there's a kind of drive to say, we've got things I need to do, things I need to write, sermons I need to write, radio interviews, blogs or whatever. So that kind of drives you. I don't know if that's bad, but I suppose it does wake you up in the morning. So where would you go with that, Glenn? So someone answers those kind of questions, where would you encourage people to go when people have said that?
Well, I think when people do talk about family and they talk about love, I think it's where you go is like, do you think that is like fundamental? Do you think that stuff is like really important? Or do you believe that actually any of these things can be snatched away by a car wreck? And I do think we've got this strange view in sort of secular Britain where you just think, okay, we are just biological survival machines. We're clinging to an insignificant rock. We're hurtling through a meaningless universe towards eternal extinction. But I'm going somewhere nice on my holidays. Or, you know, but Starbucks have a new flavored latte, so that's nice. You know, and it's just this bizarre idea that we can somehow make meaning that will sustain us out of this raw materials of just, we are just, you know, brain chemistry fizzing. And so where I kind of go with it is I really think that love of family, and I really think that, you know, people bound together in love and community goes all the way down and all the way back. I really do think there is a God of love who, you know, brought this world into being that we might share in that love. And I think the further I step away from that love story, the less I'm able to make sense of just the everyday stuff of life. Because the everyday stuff of life is, you know, when relationships go well, it's heaven. And when they go badly, it's hell. Why is that? We seem to already believe that love is ultimate. But, you know, with the Jesus story, here's your one shot at a story that actually makes sense of that view, because we've come from love and we're called to love. Every other story of the world doesn't make sense of your dearest intuitions about life. So that's where I'm trying to go when I'm trying to talk about, what gets you up in the morning, love. Why do you think that's most important?
When you go through that, I mean, I'm just hearing people kind of, when we've talked about these kind of things, and the comeback would be, well, are we then just using people here as projects? Because we've gone from, they've told about us, about their family, and then we're kind of going straight to, well, yeah, what about in terms of, you know, bigger questions of life? Is there a place where actually we should just be spending time kind of actually understanding their family, talking with them about that before we kind of go? Or are we thinking, does it depend on the circumstance? You know, how would you go with that?
Oh, sure. And especially if they've just said, well, actually, my son's just being diagnosed with this very serious thing. We're not sure how we're going to cope with it. The last thing in the world you want to do is you know, go down some pre-prepared evangelistic track. I think we tend to divorce evangelism and pastoral care. We tend to think that on the one hand, you've got the evangelist who's just this forehead like flint person who just shoots their mouth off no matter what the situation, and they'll give people their 4 points gospel presentation or whatever, no matter what the situation is. On the other hand, you've got the pastoral person who is just endlessly pouring cups of tea and asking, and how did that make you feel, and how did that make you feel? Whereas I think within the Bible, pastoral care and evangelism is kind of the same thing. You know, evangelism is pastoring non-Christians, and pastoral care is evangelizing Christians. We've got the same gospel for both. So absolutely you're sensitive to if they've just told you something about their family that you're curious about. You know, almost the first top tip in evangelism is be curious. Be curious. Ask questions. Delve down into that stuff. Because what's interesting is that when you raise family, I think 10% of the time people, you know, will tell you the good stories, and they've just, you know, they've just held their firstborn in their arms and they've never felt more alive, and what is this miracle that they're holding? And at that point, I think it's very, it's very natural to then talk about the God of love and the miracle that this birth is. But 90% of the time when people talk about families, they're talking about problems. And so that's interesting as we move on to the second question, you know, what gets you down? Interestingly, people answer the same thing for what gets you up as what gets you down. What gets you down, again, is family.
What do you tend to answer, Mark, for what gets you down? I threw that one at you.
Yeah, work. I mean, I think...
working with me.
No, that's a joy, Dad. I think it is. I guess it's what you're facing at that moment, isn't it? You know, we're in the season of life where we're having to think about caring about aging parents, teenage children. Mm. You know, they're all. I guess it's also my character. I'm not so much in that way. I'm always an optimist, so I'm going to be much more thinking about not necessarily what gets me down in that way, but what is the struggles right now? Where's the tension for me, rather than what gets me actually down? But that's probably just me. So
yeah, I think what gets me down is often failure. Failure or broken relationships probably get me down the most. I don't get anxious about money. I'm a hypochondriac, so I get anxious about health, but that's quite irrational and short-lived. But I think failure is one. What's your experience, Glenn, in chatting with people?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's just interesting. And if somebody did say failure to me, I just want to be curious. I just want to be, you know, has that always been the case? Can you think of times when you've really failed in your formative years, and did that shape you and things like that? And, you know, what does it mean to fail? Fail at what? So you'd want to get curious about those sorts of things. But so often, you know, men tend to be interested in things, and women tend to be interested in people, and that's just a psychological truth that people tend to tilt in those sorts of ways. And so men do tend to give those answers about failure, and particularly failure at work, and women tend to give answers around people and about failed relationships and things that go wrong. And of course, many men are worried about failed relationships, and many women are worried about failed careers. Of course, that's true. But those are the sorts of directions that you tend to go in. And at that stage, I start to think in terms of what Tim Keller says about idols. So his stuff in Counterfeit Gods, a very good book from probably, I don't know, about 10, 15 years ago now. But he said that the thing with idols is that they don't fulfill you when you get them, and they don't forgive you when you fail them. And that's just interesting. So not that I'd necessarily say that to the non-Christian friend that I'm talking to, but that's going on in the back of my head. What is the idol going on, such that when they get it, they think it'll fulfill them, and when they fail it, it feels like death to them. I'm trying to kind of diagnose that. And then it's not really at this stage about offering solutions. Actually, it's really about bearing my own soul. And talking about the frustration that I am to myself, and how, you know, nobody sabotaged my happiness better than I have. Nobody sabotaged my own success better than I have. I am like a walking contradiction. And at that point, you know, as I'm wanting to, have a gospel chat with somebody, if I want them to admit their need of forgiveness, let's say, the thing I need to do is I need to go first. If I'm wanting someone to admit sin, I need to go first. And so I'll just tell some stories about what a total disaster area I am. And I am the greatest frustration that I have with myself. And that, you know, with some people, they just think, oh, Glenn, you need, you know, better self-esteem. But for those who God is preparing, that becomes the invitation for them to start to get in touch with their needs. And then you're really having a good conversation when people really see their needs.
Yeah, what's interesting in those two questions, maybe the think and the other question might say a bit more, but in those two questions, you haven't asked whether they believe in God, whether they have a faith, what they think about the origins of the world. None of those questions yet. So is that a kind of definite tactic that you've got?
I mean, I ask different questions in different settings, and these four are just ways of having a good conversation that hopefully can develop into a God conversation. At this stage, I'm doing what sociologists might teach you to do or psychologists might teach you to do, but obviously trying to do it as a Christian. There are other questions I could ask people, but these four are more about having the kind of conversation where you actually go deep with somebody else, a conversation where they might trust you a little bit, and a conversation where you can start to bring to bear some of your own testimony. Yeah.
So how do you bring in the thinking question, though? Because I can see, you know, these questions go up, down, you know, what are you thinking? It seems like a very personal question, particularly in a relationship. Maybe I don't know them that well. You know,
or a challenging question.
Or challenging. Yeah, I was kind of envisioning sitting in the barber's chair and what are you thinking?
And I guess what gets you thinking is kind of shorthand for... sometimes I'll phrase it like this, and I use this language because it communicates to the non-Christian, not particularly because it communicates well to the Christian, but I ask them, have you ever had a religious experience? Have you ever had a religious experience? And I think, certainly in the sort of church circles that I move in, we don't like religion and we really don't like experiences. So so that kind of language doesn't really work in our circles. But people know what you mean when you say, have you ever had a religious experience? They know that you're pointing at, have you ever had an experience of something more? That there is something more out there. And so what gets you thinking is just an opportunity for people to say, you know what, when I trekked the Andes and I looked out at the stars, I had that feeling of awe. Or when I held my firstborn in my arms for the first time and I tried to wonder where on earth this new life had come from, I was dumbstruck. Or it could be, you know, when both my parents died in the same year and I realized that I was sort of top of the family tree and there was nobody above me. It felt, you know, in that way. Or, you know, when I was made redundant, there are good experiences and there are bad experiences that really open people up to just getting out of the everyday grind. And that's what you're trying to do with this question, I guess.
Sometimes in my experience, people also talk about God being present with them, a sense that there is someone or something looking over them, ordering history, kind of making what goes around comes around sort of thing. Is that your experience too?
Yeah, a lot of people think that. And one temptation is to kind of correct their theology in that moment. And that might be appropriate. But don't shut them down, you know. Let them keep talking. Let them keep talking. And what are the probing questions that I might ask is, if they do have some kind of concept of God, if they're happy using the name God for that, I would just say, does this God that you're talking about love us? Because what's very interesting to me is that so often people have a vision for God that is almost indistinguishable from electricity. Electricity is very powerful, and if you get it wrong, you get zapped. If you can figure out how to harness it, then you can use the energy of electricity to serve your life. But energy is this distant power, basically. And that's what a lot of people think God is. You know, God is this distant energy that's just humming and all around us and that sort of thing. And, you know, when people talk about God is energy and things like that, or a higher power, you know, it can sound nice, but when you just do some, you know, probe some questions to say, you know, does this God love you? You know, they might say yes, I suppose, but you know, it's hard for an energy to love you. Electricity doesn't love me. And then, you know, if the moment is right, you can talk about, you know, the God I believe in, you know, Jesus, the night before he died, he said, Father, you loved me before the foundation of the world. So Jesus says that he was there before the beginning of the world, and he says that there was always a Father loving him and filling him with the Holy Spirit, this God of love, and he's the kind of God who comes from that fountain of love into our world to give us that love. That's the kind of God that I believe in. And I think if you've been curious enough about their vision of God, I think they can do the Pepsi challenge. I think they can taste and see that what you're talking about knocks the spots off their vision of God.
I think that's it's a great way through, isn't it? Just to start helping people think about how they think about God. By kind of just being curious, asking those questions. How do you then move on to that final question? So you've got them thinking now, they're thinking about the type of God, if I put it that way. How do you get them to, you know, what is it you're thinking through, or what gets you through, is it? What gets you through life? Presumably.
Yeah, what gets you through? What gets you through? And and at this point, you know, I start to reference a question that's from another set of four questions that I've developed to help people with their everyday evangelism. And it's a way of finishing the sentence that says, I couldn't have gotten through X without Jesus. And it's a very personal thing. And when I do it in evangelism training, I'm always very careful and you know, it's surrounded by prayer, because it's actually a really precious thing to turn to your neighbor and say, I couldn't have gotten through our third miscarriage without Jesus. I couldn't have gotten through losing both parents, you know, without Jesus. I couldn't have gotten through that diagnosis without Jesus. These are very, you know, personal times. And you'll have to judge it in a conversation. Am I willing to go there and to open up about some of the tenderest parts of me? But it's so fruitful when you do. And if you've got the kind of relationship where you can do this, you can say to your friend, look, you know, when I had those rounds of operations and it was touch and go, you'll know how hairy that all was. And yet I couldn't have gotten through 2017 without Jesus. And you can start to talk about the way that Jesus has shepherded you through the valley of the shadow of death. And that's, you know, that really is bringing together pastoral care and evangelism all in one. And it really is showing that evangelism is just pastoring a non-Christian and just saying, you've got a valley of the shadow too. The trouble is you don't have a shepherd to see you through. How do you cope? And that leads to some very deep conversations.
So interestingly, on that one, you wouldn't necessarily start with a question. You would start with personal testimony in that sense. You're beginning, in other words, you're beginning to help people connect and see how following Jesus makes a difference in your life.
Right. And I do think our testimonies need to be shaped more by that. I think so often the testimonies that we prepare and that we we practice and that we try to give to our friends, they basically narrate a spiritual journey that we've been on, you know. And I either did grow up in a Christian home or I didn't grow up in a Christian home. And we feel like, you know, the story is a bad story if I grew up in a Christian home. And then we have to invent these wilderness years for ourselves that might not be true. We have to throw our youth leaders under the bus saying, they never taught me the gospel, but then I discovered Jesus when I was 20 years old. And, you know, and so often we have to, because we're trying to tell a story where I am the hero of the story, and where it's all about how I went from a position of not knowing Jesus to knowing Jesus, I think that we shoot ourselves in the foot so often when that's the paradigm for our testimonies. Not least because it's somebody who's grown up in a Christian home who can never remember a time when they didn't love Jesus. They still have a wonderful testimony to give. Mm. And here's the testimony that they can give. The testimony they can give is, look, when I had that double mastectomy, I could not have known the presence of Jesus that was more real and dear to me. Like, and in the midst of, you know, staring death in the face, I had a peace that was beyond all understanding because Jesus met me. And if you can say that to a friend who knows that that is true for you, they don't care whether you grew up in a Christian home or not. What they want to know is, does Jesus meet us in the valley of the shadow? And you say, yes, he does. And you put words to that.
Because I think that's part of the problem we often with our values, that we understandably focus much more on death, eternal life, or hell, but we don't therefore help connect it for people in terms of what it looks like for our own just daily lives now. Talking to, you know, someone the other day, yesterday, they were just in terms of, yeah, but what difference does it make to my life now? I can become a believer much later. I don't need to worry about it. I just need to worry about eternal life. You know, Jesus makes no difference to me now. There's no benefit to me. Now, of course, that's missing lots of other stuff, but it reveals often where we are in terms of our own evangelism, that we're actually we focus sometimes all our energy on the end and not just on, hey, this is living the Christian life every day. You know, of Jesus being with us and talking with Jesus and having a relationship with Jesus now.
Mm. It's about purpose, isn't it? So if you're giving a testimony of that kind to say, here's a great utility for life, it helped me through my medical emergency and it could help you through your medical emergency, I think that's a wrong way to evangelize, because there's lots of tips and techniques that will help you through. But if you're telling it to give an authentic testimony of how God is affecting you, not to sell it as a technique, but just to say it's real. I think that's the better testimony. Although it's really helpful, Glenn, to talk about you not being the hero of the story, because I grew up in a Christian home, and even in my age and experience, sometimes I want to make my testimony a bit more glamorous than it is, and I've got the ability to do that because I speak a lot. And it's really helpful just to think about that. I often talk about in my testimony my dad dying now, because he died about 15 years ago, and just the experience of my dad dying and having to really be challenged as to whether I actually believe the gospel, because he was a Christian. Where was he? You know, his body's lifeless now on a bed. What do I actually believe? And that is, in a way, much more interesting than what happened when I was 16. Really helpful. We've got a few minutes left, so I think what might just be interesting is just for your take on, do you think the problem is we don't have enough evangelistic events, or do you think the problem is down at the nuts and bolts level we've been talking about mostly, which is individuals, and the events kind of flow out of that? It's more about individual Christians not getting an appetite and an enthusiasm for evangelism themselves.
Yeah, the latter, absolutely the latter. I mean, I very happily say no to churches who just feel like they ought to put on events, but are not ready for it. And in fact, just this year, I did a week with a church, and they pulled the plug on it for last year because they just weren't ready. The Christians in the church weren't really embedded in the community. They didn't have the friendships with non-Christians that would, you know, so that invitations would make any sense. And they put it off for a year because they weren't ready. And that was a great decision. And not doing evangelistic events can be exactly the right decision for a church. I do believe that conversion is an event, and I do resist when people constantly want to make conversion into this sociological phenomenon. They constantly want to tell you the statistics about how many conversations it requires for somebody to finally have finally trust in Jesus. Because theologically, we know that you turn from idols to serve the living and true God when you hear the word and you go from death to life. You have a Lazarus experience, and that is an event, right? And so I think having an evangelistic model that reflects our theology and reflects the fact that people can walk into a building lost and they can leave that building saved, I think that is to honor the theology that we have, that conversion really is an event. So I do believe in events, but I don't believe in having them for their own sake, and they must always be a part of the ongoing life of the church. And of course, the great event in the life of the church is every Sunday morning. You know, we gather together and we remember the resurrection of Jesus. And, you know, we, depending on your tradition, but, you know, we all sing songs together. We all have the word of Christ dwell in our hearts richly. So, yes, there are events in the ongoing life of the church, but those events are to serve the ongoing life of the church, and they are to send you out. So, you know, from the Anglican tradition that I'm in, you're meant to, at the end of events, such as Sunday morning, you're meant to say, go in peace to love and serve the Lord, and out you go and out you flow as these missionaries. So I certainly don't think that putting on events is the right thing to do in any way, shape, or form. But they can be just little dew points around which evangelistic endeavor can collect. So that if you've got, you will have keen evangelists in your congregations, probably not as many as you think you have or that you hope you have, but you do have keen evangelists that are getting into great conversations week by week. But don't put on the events until you need to put on events. Really, it's about the ongoing life of a missional community just taking Jesus out to their daily, ordinary lives.
Brilliant. That is so good. Thank you so much, Glenn, for your time with us on these two podcasts. We've really appreciated it.
Yeah, thanks, Glenn.
Real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, we'll speak to you again soon, no doubt.
Once again, a big thank you to Glenn for being with us for these two great podcasts. And if you want to hear more from Glenn, then do head over to speaklife.org.uk. There's lots going on over there, including award-winning video resources, blogs, you can book speakers for events, and there's even a Speak Life podcast. So you should definitely go and subscribe to that. Keep emailing us. We love to hear your thoughts and questions and ideas for future topics. And do keep sharing Ordinary with your friends and family too. Thanks for listening, and come back next week for another brand new episode of Ordinary.